The Guardian.
Welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, yes, he's back from the moon. Actor Sam Rockwell stars alongside Hilary Swank in the tearjerker Conviction, one of the big premieres at the current London Film Festival. I meet up with Sam to talk sibling bonds and justice. I also meet up with director Clio Barnard to discuss her artistic, poetic evocation of the life of Bradford writer Andrea Dunbar. The film is The Arbor, and I tell you, it's one of my favourites of the year so far. And it may be just a dim and painful memory banished to the back of the brain of England fans, but this year's South African World Cup is the inspiration and backdrop for Africa United, a coming-of-age road movie by British filmmaker Deborah Gardner-Patterson. I meet up with Debs and her effervescent young cast to talk film, family and football. Yes, the only cuts we're interested in are director's cuts. It's Film Weekly. One of the most recognisable yet unusual actors in Hollywood is Sam Rockwell. I'm delighted to say he's a regular face in London too, following recent years in three top UK-related films such as Moon, Frost Nixon and The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He was even here this week at the London Film Festival with a classic Hollywood tale of injustice overcome by love and familial bonds. In Conviction, slated for a UK release early next year, Rockwell stars alongside Hilary Swank as a down-at-heel brother and sister. The film then follows Swank as the devoted sister and working-class mum, Betty Ann Waters, who puts herself through 16 years of law school just to rescue her brother from a life in prison for a crime he did not commit.
So this is what I'm going to do, Ian. Don't laugh, all right? I'm going to stop by trying to get a BA after I finally take this stupid GED test, and after that, if I even get that far, and there's no guarantee I'll even get in, I'll apply to law school. It's gonna take a long time, Kenny, a really long time. And I mean, I might be 80 years old before I finally become a lawyer. And even then, I still don't know if I'm gonna find the answers. But you just have to promise me. You just have to. That you won't ever try to kill yourself ever again. Because if you do, just don't.
Okay.
Sam Rockwell, what an absolute pleasure to welcome you on Film Weekly.
Hey, thanks.
Congratulations on Conviction.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
It was an interesting role for me to see you in, because it wouldn't be the sort of thing that I would normally see Sam Rockwell in, but I'm really delighted.
I liked it. Tell me what it is about the part. It's just sort of a different kind of...
Yeah.
He's
interview me.
I'll interview you. Well, he's got a baby. That's one thing. You don't usually see me with babies, I guess. True.
Yeah, you're not a big fan of them.
No, I love babies. I just I don't like them all around all the time.
Yeah. No, you're very good with them. They're really dancing in the pub.
I've done the baby thing, and there was a movie called Joshua. We had a lot of babies on set.
Yeah, I mean, just funnily enough, I'm going to go right back to 1997, I think, and Lawn Dogs, which is, I think, maybe it might have been the first time that I saw you on screen. It was the first time I certainly you had a kind of a lead role, and that's a long time ago.
That's right. I was staying at Hazlitt's, Frith, yeah. We were just talking about that. That was a lot of fun. My first press tour.
And that was when I first met you. So it's been great. That's why I say it's kind of an odd film, because it is a big kind of, it's almost kind of a big kind of old fashioned studio picture in a way, this one.
Yeah, it is. You're right. And it's the kind of movie that studios were making even 10 years ago, and they're not making as much anymore. Mm. So this is an independent film, actually.
Oh, right. So, I mean, does it represent some kind of a gamble? Because it's an adult drama in that kind of way. You know, there's no special effects. And I suppose after Iron Man 1 and 2, you've probably had enough of effects movies. But that's what I mean. It was kind of back to the acting.
Yeah, I think it's harder to make a drama these days. They're harder to finance, but they're just so much fun for actors, and I think for the audience too. I think there's something cathartic about watching this film, at least when I watch it. But of course, I'm biased, you know. Mm-hmm.
You know, I watched it when I saw your film, and before I went in, the Chilean miners were coming out. You know, by the time the end of your film had happened, like two more miners had come out. You know, and your movie is about, you know, someone who's kind of, you know, out after all these years. And you know what, I was, you know, I think your movie's a bit corny, but I was in bits by the end of it.
You know, me too. Again, I'm biased, but I even the music makes me, you know, weep like a little baby. It's you know, I really am proud of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that hard as an actor? Because you know that you're on a kind of a tear-jerking kind of tip here. Yeah. You know what you're doing with this film, and you have to kind of hit those marks. Is there that kind of tendency to kind of do too much?
There can be, but, you know, the camera doesn't lie, and so you really have to be as truthful as you can be, and that's about it. Mm.
Because obviously you have to work with Hillary, although you're kind of incarcerated, you still get a few good scenes, those visiting scenes and touching the window scenes and the kind of those interrogation scenes.
Absolutely.
How's playing with her? It was really good to see the two of you together, two really kind of strong independent actors kind of in this big studio picture, or picture anyway.
No, I mean, she's amazing. I liken her to any great actor, whether it's, you know, Helen Mirren or Meryl Streep or Daniel Day-Lewis or Sean Penn, you know, I mean, she's as good as they come, you know. She's so focused. She's really like a force of nature, you know. She's a fiercely focused person.
Does that make you up your game?
Absolutely. I was definitely intimidated, and I wanted to bring my A game. And these were, you know, difficult scenes to do. I mean, the circumstances are pretty extraordinary, you know, so you have to step up to the plate.
Yeah. Did you film in a real jail?
We did. It was a non-working prison, and so that vibe was prevalent. You could feel it. You know.
I have a little baby, and this is the thing. I was watching that. If I couldn't see my little baby for 16 years, I mean, that was kind of what got me, and I guess that's what's going to get everyone in the film.
Sure.
There's where you kind of got, but you really downplay that at the end. It was really, you don't need to do much, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the circumstance itself is so emotional, and you know, Ari Grainer, the actress who plays my daughter, does a lot of the work there. Mm. For both of us in that scene, you know.
Had you any? I mean, I loved you in Moon as well, of course,
thanks,
last year. And we meant to see you for Moon, but you couldn't get over, and that was a whole thing.
Yeah.
And it was odd seeing you in one kind of a low budget sci-fi, but there was distance involved there and pain and separation again. And I found that could you go from one of the two characters to the other? Did you think of Moon while you were kind of in solitary there?
You know, I've played a lot of solitary characters. Yeah, it seems to be a theme with me. I don't know what that is. I'll talk to my shrink about it.
Yeah, you seem very nice to me.
I'm basically a nice person,
And they should give you some more friends on screen.
Yes, we got to work on that. A romantic comedy.
Sam Rockwell, I'd love to see you in a romantic comedy.
Yeah, like, me too. Thanks, man.
I'll tell Richard Curtis next time I see him.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
Thanks, man. Thanks a lot.
First, you need an erection.
An erection?
An erection.
What's that?
I don't know.
Do you know what an hard-on is?
Yeah.
Okay. First, you need an hard-on, and then you take the rubber johnny, as you call it, out the packet.
We didn't think, we thought you could put packet on, did you?
Sex education, Yorkshire style there, seen from the 1986 film Rita Sue and Bob 2. Alan Clarke's film was a huge success, but for the young playwright who wrote the original script, Andrea Dunbar, it further estranged her from the poor post-industrial Bradford in which she grew up. Dunbar was a precocious talent, writing her first play when she was just 15, but her success as a writer couldn't alter her alcoholism or her premature death at the age of 29 from a brain hemorrhage in a pub. Using Dunbar's own dramatic genius and the unfolding tragedy of her and her children's lives, director Clio Barnard now crafts a poetic, layered film entitled The Arbour.
I just didn't agree with anything that she said. She was more or less blaming my mum for her being on drugs. I won't ever use my mum dying as an excuse for anything that I've ever done in my life, really. Because we've all got to learn by his mistakes.
And I'm delighted to say that Clio Barnard joins me in the studio to tell me more about her, I may say, brilliant film, The Arbour. It is an extraordinary piece of work, and I think most people will be sort of wrong-footed by it. But then I do remember Andrea Dunbar's films and work being very wrong-footing for anyone who watched them. Was your attempt to kind of do what you do, an attempt to capture that spirit of freshness again?
I don't know that I set out with that intention.
You did.
Thank you.
You did it.
Thank you.
So you were obviously kind of intrigued by Andrea Dunbar's work and via her work into her life. So can you just tell us a bit about what you found about Andrea Dunbar, who Andrea Dunbar was, for those who have yet to see her work and know about her life?
Well, she wrote, it was a CSE assignment, she wrote The Arbor. And then Max Sapir-Clarke really nurtured her talent, I suppose, in a way.
In a school exercise book.
Yeah, apparently famously written in green ink. And I think he felt it really stood out. It was sent in for the Young Writers Festival.
At the Royal Court.
Yeah, at the Royal Court. And then it was put on at the Royal Court. She wrote a second act for it. Then she wrote Rita Sue and Bob 2, which was adapted for Alan Clark's film. And she then went on to write a play called Shirley. So she had a sort of brief but very brilliant career.
And she'd never even been to a theatre when she wrote her first play? Never seen a play in her life?
No, she hadn't.
I mean, this sounds an extraordinary kind of place for a kind of a voice, an independent voice, theatrical voice to emerge from. What was her actual family life like?
She was one of eight kids, I think. Yeah, she was one of eight. And very poor, difficult background, I would say.
So you thought you'd kind of do a sort of examine Andrea Dunbar's life, and then you discover the story of her daughters. Because, I mean, I didn't know the story of her daughters at all until I've seen your film. So what made you kind of go, well, the best way to examine Andrea Dunbar's life and legacy is through her daughters?
It sort of happened the other way around, because Lorraine, Andrea's one of Andrea's daughters, her words end this play, A State Affair. And she makes the connection back to Rita, Sue and Bob too. So she says, if my mum wrote the play now, Rita and Sue would be smackheads on crack as well. Bob would probably be using, Rita and Sue would be sleeping with anybody and everybody for money. And I really knew that I wanted to speak to her, but at the point at which it'd already been commissioned, I didn't know what happened to Lorraine. So I knew that I wanted to interview her, but I didn't know her story. And then I spoke to Andrea's sister, Pamela, and I realised how autobiographical her play The Arbor is, that she wrote when she was 15. She wrote half of it when she was 15, then the other half when she was 18. And there's a character, Yusuf, in the play, and I realised that was Lorraine's father. And it was at that point that the focus became her play The Arbor, the street Brafferton Arbor, and really her relationship with her daughters. But as the film goes on, it becomes much more focused on Lorraine.
Yeah. And your decision artistically to use actors rather than go and film documentary style Lorraine herself, was that always your intention, the verbatim style that Max Sapir-Clarke, who is played by someone else in fact in this anyway, why did you use that? Why did you go for that?
That idea of actors lip syncing to the voices was there right from the very beginning. So that was in the sort of original proposal. So that was the intention, but then in the process of making it, there were things that happened that I guess I'd half anticipated, but I, like, Lorraine didn't want her face to be on camera. And subsequently, you know, her foster parents are very pleased that their faces aren't on camera for various reasons. So I think it gave a degree of anonymity, and also, I think a camera changes things, and so the interviews were just audio like this, and I think it allowed those interviews to be more intimate.
And then you take the plays out, the other kind of artistic coup de cinema, coup de théâtre, coup de whatever it is, you take the plays out into the streets, the modern streets of that estate, and perform them there on kind of old sofas, which I thought was brilliant, worked brilliantly for me. And I love all the kind of passers-by walking their dogs going, hang on, what's going on here? And that's that play between documentary and reality and fiction and theatre, I suppose, street theatre in a way, which I don't think I've ever seen it in cinema before.
There's an Alan Clark TV piece called Road, which I really love, and it's it's a piece of theatre but for television.
Yeah,
it's
the
not
Jim Cartwright.
Yeah, the Jim Cartwright. Play, yeah. No, I really love that.
That's how Alan Clark did that bit. I mean, because one of your actors is in that as well, isn't it?
Yeah, Neil Dudgeon. Neil, yeah. I'm very impressed.
Well, I think the people that saw, you know, Alan Clark's film, Jim Cartwright, so that period was very intensely kind of creative for Britain. It was sort of top Thatcher era. And I think anyone, all of our generation who saw that were very kind of impressed theatrically. It was kind of the new theatre. It kind of has probably influenced all our aesthetic in some way, in a term of kind of continuing on. In the way that Kathy Come Home must have influenced loads of people in the 60s that saw that kind of Ken Loach realism. And before that, the Lindsay Anderson stuff. This, I think, was our kitchen sink moment.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
You can come again.
Yeah. And actually, it's funny because the thing of performing what we end up calling the Arbour on the Arbour, which is the scenes from the play on Brafton Arbour, the street where she grew up. In a way, that was the big risk for me, not the lip syncing. And so when we set up for that very first scene, which is, you know, basically we put some car seats on this piece of grass and then got some were actors, some were non-actors, you know, some were people from the estate. I did kind of think, this is insane. What am I doing? And it wasn't really until I saw the first assembly, the first cut, that I realised that it was really working, and that because it's kind of like a breath of fresh air in the film, because the interviews are quite claustrophobic and intense, and then you get this performance of the play and it's like someone opens a window.
Really does. I mean, I think the first quote of the film, it's one I've written down first, it's almost a mantra for the film itself. She says, "I don't think you remember the good stuff."
Yeah, I think the decision to put that at the very beginning came fairly late on in the process, and the other, the scene with the fire where Lorraine and Lisa both remember this same moment from their past, but they remember it, they've got completely contradictory memories of this same thing, and that felt very important, and that was sort of further down the line in terms of the narrative structure, and got kind of put right up at the front. And I think that was really important to establish that, you know, there are many, many different versions of Andrea Dunbar, and depending on who you ask, even her two daughters, you know, you could be talking about a different woman.
There's a lovely bit where it just kind of goes, "I don't think she died in the pub, but she practically lived there anyway." And it's a lovely, I mean, it's almost like, God, did Andrea Dunbar write that line? Mm. There's some interesting play here. I mean, I don't think Andrea Dunbar, I don't know how, it was almost as she predicted her own life in a way, that or the life after her. I mean, they seem like characters in an Andrea Dunbar play, and I'm sure it wasn't you didn't sculpt them in that way. That it was that not an eerie discovery to make, the further you delved into this kind of family that she created in reality?
I think that her three children seem to have that ability to talk about things that are very complex and difficult in an incredibly direct way, and have this real ability to, you know, I don't have the same ability, but they have this, yeah, they're brilliant with words, incredibly eloquent, and yeah, I love the way, you know, they speak.
I must say, I'm very delighted that you could come in, Clio, and meet you, because I really thought your work was one of the most striking films I've seen this year. I was going to say I loved it, but I've admired it immensely, and I'm very fond of the characters in this. I'm really glad you could come in to Film Weekly. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's lovely.
Thanks to Clio Barnard. The Arbour is on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 22nd of October. Now, a man who on a daily basis shifts between documentary and fiction is Guardian film critic Zam Brooks, who joins me to review some of this week's other releases.
I'm being played by an actor, actually. This is my voice, but there's a little monkey sitting in the chair.
Working you. Zam, we're going to look at Carlos this week, all sort of very in its various versions. Then you can tell me about Red, the film with Bruce Willis.
I will.
Your new mate, Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
In honour of whom you're wearing just a vest today. Well done. I'll tell you about Mary and Max, an animation from Australia. Let's talk about Carlos. This is also a strange kind of play between fiction, reality, fantasy as well, because it's Olivier Assayas, a very skilled French filmmaker, making a documentary kind of portrait of Carlos, the great international terrorist who currently is languishing in a jail in France. So we've got a real man. I spoke to the actor who plays Carlos, Edgar Ramirez, and we'll have an interview with him on the show next week. But there is a real man, and this kind of work by Olivier Assayas endeavours to kind of explain him a bit.
The Algerians have doubled the offer. They're offering $20 million for the lives of the hostages.
Sadding us! Revolutionaries and not bandits!
The revolution needs us alive.
I killed two men and didn't do it for money!
What do you want then? A bloodbath?
Yes!
That would be a failure! For us and for the cause!
And then I prefer failure to shame!
I swore to make success of our mission. I gave my word. I weighed already the pros and cons of the entire situation. This is the best thing to do.
The sound of Carlos. I don't know which bit that was taken from, because, of course, this film, I saw it over 5 hours, 40 minutes in Cannes. Yeah. It then played out on French TV as a miniseries over three consecutive Wednesdays. I think it's being released in America that way. Mm. There's now a 2.5 hour sort of festival version theatrical version
that's going out in
theatres here.
But there's also the longer version. You can still see that in some cinemas as well.
Yeah, over an afternoon. I think it's playing as a matinee.
Right, okay.
So, you know, work out which Carlos, which one should you go and see?
I think you should go and see the long one.
Yeah.
I think you should go for the long haul. It was made as a five and a half hour miniseries. That's how it should be seen, even if you have to sit there for 5.5 hours and endure it.
Because
I've seen both. I've seen both, and you know, the shorter version is still great, but you keep kind of, there keeps being these huge gaps where you suddenly realise it's like kind of falling asleep in something and waking up and thinking, oh my God, I've missed like
40
minutes.
It's a bit like kind of doing, like watching The Wire and sort of just missing a couple of episodes because you were out at dinner or something and you couldn't, and you forgot to record it and you didn't get it.
And so it's not the full, it's not the full
but it still is good, right?
It's still very good. He's an amazingly talented director, I think, Assayas.
I've never seen him do anything like this before. This is kind of
he's almost sort of willful. Perverse, isn't he? He kind of does different things. I remember seeing Irma Vep probably about 12 years ago and thinking, this guy is amazing, and then going to see a few of his other films after that and him confounding me and being very irritated with him when he did like Le Destiné Sentimental,
which is a costume drama
and thinking, what's he doing here?
Yeah.
But he's
deliberately...
And then he's
Demon Lover with a sort of sci-fi kind of
Boarding Gate, which was awful.
Yeah, it wasn't very good.
And then Summer Hours last year, which was good. So he's sort of back on form. And this, I think, is a great film.
Yeah, you do, okay.
I really do.
Right, because it's interesting, because the guy at the centre of it, Carlos, presumably you don't think he's a great man, or maybe you do?
Not at all. He wants to be seen as a great man. He wants to be seen as Che Guevara, this great Marxist revolutionary who's fighting to overturn the capitalist system. And yet, Assayas makes him out to be a Marxist protagonist in a much broader sense, in that he's a victim of history. He's totally compromised. It's got a great sense of, I guess, what we now see as the prehistory of modern-day terrorism, right down to the hijacking of an airliner in his great kind of OPEC hostage crisis of 75. But also these names keep popping up. You keep hearing, like, Jacques Chirac mentions Saddam Hussein has a sort of off-screen role, Yasser Arafat. And so there's this sense that this is the cauldron of terrorism, that the issues that we're facing now, and that he was stitched into that, but not leading it, as much a victim of it as everybody else.
So you see it very much as a kind of tapestry of the times, rather, seen through the prism of one man kind of thing.
I think so. I think it does have that sort of Greek tragedy arc, where he starts out as this sort of vital, charismatic figure and then just gets kind of corroded by events.
Yes. I mean, a lot of people absolutely love it. It's one of the cinematic events of the year, in an art house kind of slant, really. I just wish I'd loved it more. And I couldn't, because of this guy. I don't like him.
I think you've got to sit through it again.
I'm certainly not going to do that, I must tell you. Why don't you tell me about Red instead? Because I saw the big premiere was in London. You've been hanging out with Bruce. What did you do with Bruce?
I hung out with Bruce for all of about 2 minutes.
Yeah? That's enough, surely. That's
enough Bruce for anyone.
Tell me about... Well, before you tell me about Red, I'm going to give people a little flavour of it because Bruce survives an attempted assassination and then he goes off he's worried that one of his cohorts... I haven't seen this film, as you can probably
tell. You
could
basically play a clip from any Bruce Willis film and it would be...
Do you think? No one will know.
Yeah,
have a guess what this one is.
I'm not going to hurt you. Would you just listen to me?
Is that my bag?
Yeah.
You packed it?
Yes.
Did you vacuum?
A little, yeah. It was messy.
Get back. Get out.
Please.
Get out.
We have to leave right now.
Get out.
Stop. Hey, listen to me, please.
Help!
Someone is trying to kill me. What are you doing? Listen to me.
Help!
They're trying to kill you, too.
Why would anyone want to kill me?
Because we've been under surveillance. They've been listening to our conversations.
Why?
They know I like you.
There you go. Who was that? Penelope Ann Miller?
No, it was Mary Louise Parker.
Mary Louise Parker.
You're getting your three name actresses all scrambled.
Mary Louise Parker. I like her normally.
She's,
when I can differentiate.
Here she's basically playing the kind of the scream queen, I guess. Bruce goes to as we heard in that thing, and this is basically their first encounter, and he immediately tapes her up, sticks duct tape over her mouth and drags her off to a cheap motel and lashes her to the bed.
You speak as if he did this with you just yesterday.
He really wanted to. But I wasn't playing ball. And from there, we basically get an extended caper movie. One of those movies in which everybody is firing guns, everyone's chucking grenades, bombs are going off, helicopters are sort of have cannons, nobody really gets killed.
Wasn't that The Expendables?
Well, it is The Expendables, and Willis is really trading on the sort of weight of his history, his action movie history.
Because it's from what the poster is, Willis, it's Malkovich, it's Mirren.
Red is retired, extremely dangerous.
Ah.
So he's a sort of black ops agent who is forced out of retirement. He's bored out of his mind in suburbia and then comes back because they're trying to kill him for this secret in the past. And yes, it's got this cast where you've got the other retired agents, Morgan Freeman basically playing Morgan Freeman, John Malkovich playing the sort of wild-eyed paranoiac who drags women aside at airports and says, "You smell like Washington." And often
is
he's
funny?
Right. He's kind of good. Everybody's hammy in this. And that's probably, you've got Brian Cox as the sort of Russian agent who says, "I have not killed anybody for many years." And so everybody's really amping it up.
Is it funny?
No.
Is it supposed to be?
I think it's supposed to be.
Would it help if it was?
Do you know, I didn't mind it. I think it's ludicrous. It's totally unreconstructed. It's dodgy. And it's overlong. And yet, within that, it sort of does the business.
Shall I tell you about Mary and Max?
Please do.
Well, you can listen to Mary and Max. Here is Mary, played by Toni Collette, writing to Max about her neighbour, Mr. Papadopoulos, and how he thinks he's lovely, but her mother doesn't.
Papadopoulos. He's a Greek. And smells like lemon dishwashing liquid. And his skin is smooth like the back of a spoon. Mum says he's a wog and has a stutter and can't even say his own surname. She says you have to hit him on the back of the head to get his words out. I wish he was my boyfriend and we can be in love and do sexy.
You have to imagine there Toni Collette as a little claymation kind of figure with little kind of movie eyebrows, kind of Morphe type kind
is
of thing.
Is this like A Town Called Panic all over again?
What is it with them animation?
I
mean, they're just every week there's another animation that really shouldn't be 78 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't need to be. They're good at like 50 minutes.
Yeah.
And then you just think, well, you know, it's a claymation puppet. She has this friendship with this guy called Max Horowitz, who's played by, or voiced by, Philip Seymour Hoffman, recognisably brilliant voiceover. That's one reason to really see this is that Philip Seymour Hoffman gives perhaps his best performance ever as this kind of weary, paranoid 50-year-old kind of Hasidic Jew in an apartment in Brooklyn. And it's just
sounds
sadness.
Like Synecdoche.
He very, very similar. I think he probably did it on his day off from Synecdoche. It's funny. It's sweet. It's almost kind of, you know, actually moving in a way. It's almost moving as claymation characters can possibly be. And you know, a bit of barking. Who's going to see it and where? I just don't know because I wouldn't really say part with your tenor and go to the cinema. No one went to see A Town Called Panic. I like that.
Yeah.
And that's out on DVD fairly soon. I suspect that that's where the audience for Mary and Max is. Very good though it is. Thanks to Zan Brooks there. Nice to see you. For more of Zan's reviews and video interviews, indeed the best film site on the worldwide interweb, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Of course, there you can find out more about the London Film Festival at bfi.org.uk/LFF. It's still going on, another week to go. Last week, we ran a competition to offer a pair of tickets to the Olivier Assayas Masterclass, the director of Carlos. We asked you which of his films was particularly hygienic in its title. That film was, of course, Clean, starring Maggie Cheung. Lots of entries, but the lucky name out of the hat is Kat Douglas. Well done, Kat. Without doubt, the feel-good film of the London Film Festival has been Africa United. Playing as the family gala, the story told of a feisty young Rwandan, Dudu, and his gang who head out on a 3,000-mile journey to the 2010 South African World Cup opening ceremony in Soccer City, Johannesburg. Of course, many adventures ensue. I caught up with director Debs Gardner-Patterson and some of her indomitable young cast to find out more. But let's first hear a clip from Africa United.
Jean-Baptiste, I'm working with FIFA. Do you know FIFA?
Yeah. You think we're monkeys?
Beat it, kid. Am I talking to you?
You talk to him. You talk to me. I'm his manager.
Do you know of the trial in Kigali Stadium tomorrow?
Sure.
FIFA is looking for young African footballers to represent their countries at the opening ceremony of the World Cup. And I tell you, you have a very, very good chance of being selected. The trial is tomorrow, National Stadium in Kigali. In 1 month, you'll be at the World Cup.
World Cup.
Do you need money for the bus?
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Don't be late. I want you in the team for the dream. Africa United.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome onto Film Weekly the gang from Africa United. I've got almost a team here. I'm so excited to be with you guys in the studio. I saw your film, loved it, of course. All that kind of that sunshine kind of bursting off the screen, but also with a bit of darkness as well, and also about football. And you, Eria, wearing an Arsenal top all the way through. My favourite team. Great to see it represented by you. Just say hello to the Film Weekly listeners. Tell us your name and the character you play.
Hello, my name is Arianda. And I play Dudu in Africa United.
Yeah, and where are you from?
I'm from Uganda.
Yeah, representing Uganda.
Yeah.
The Indere Dance Troupe.
Yes.
Yeah, that's in Kampala, right?
Yeah, Kampala.
Yeah, excellent. We'll find out a bit more how you got into your character and you got in the team as well. But we're also joined by the guy you manage in the team, the guy who plays Fabrice. Say hello to us.
Hi, my name is Roger Nsengiyumva, and I play Fabrice in Africa United.
Yeah, you sound, however, that you've got a bit of English in you here.
Yeah, just a little
Where
bit.
Where are you from?
I'm from Rwanda, but I live in Norwich.
You live in Norwich?
Yeah.
Wow, how did that happen? That's a strange kind of journey for anyone,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Strange.
Yeah. But you're happy now, and you were trying out for Norwich, is that right? As a footballer?
Yeah, I tried out for Norwich City Academy a few years back.
And they said, what, you never amount to anything?
They said, nah, get out.
Now you are playing the big football star on the big screen. That's why Norwich are not in the Premiership.
Big up Norwich, though.
Respect to them. Stephen Fry, he's the cleverest man in the world. He supports Norwich. He must know something. And I've got with me the young girl that you pick up along the way. You can say hello.
Hi, I'm Sherry Silva. I'm 16 and I play Celeste in Africa United.
And where are you from, Sherry?
I'm from Rwanda, but I live in London.
Well done, representing as well. It is a massive cast, Africa United. I mean, I've left some outside the studio as well, so I'm really glad that you guys could come with me. The woman who kind of marshalled you all and kind of kept control is also with us, director of the film, Debs Gardner-Patterson. Welcome to Film Weekly.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
How on earth did you manage this lot? I mean, you know, Fabio Capello's got nothing on
Yeah, right. Well, we obviously had a little manager in Dudu here working behind the scenes, but no, these guys have been brilliant. They've been up for everything and anything in the shoot and beyond, so it's been good.
Yeah, well, they're a brilliant cast altogether. What was it like out there? Did you get on with these guys, Araya? They were nice to you?
Very nice.
Yeah, and because I mean, you're to blame for the whole journey. It's your big idea, your crazy, stupid idea. Where'd you get that in your head?
That's the script, man.
Would you do this journey? Because I mean, the film is about a journey, you know, people following their dreams, and obviously a lot of you guys are following a dream right now. Here you are at the London Film Festival, come all the way from Kampala.
I wouldn't do the journey because it's too long.
But Dudu would do the journey, right?
Yeah, Dudu would, but Ariel wouldn't.
But then Dudu would do anything.
Yeah, that's true. And but the thing is about Dudu, he makes other people do stuff. It's not just you could do something. He makes you do everything. And you quit your, well, obviously it's your storyline ushers in a kind of darkness to the story. It's all about hopes and dreams, but you have a bit of real politics in your story, Sherry. Yeah. Tell us about your character.
I play Celeste. She's a 15-year-old girl who had quite a hard past, and as a result she ended up working in this bar as a sex worker. It's not actually what she wanted to do, because she has always dreamt of being a journalist, but fortunately when she met the group, the Africa United team, they helped her leave the bar and achieve the dream which she wanted to achieve. Yeah. As well as watching them achieve their dreams as well.
Yeah, because that's the other part of that. You kind of join in to see that, that other people can do stuff as well, and that the rest of the world isn't as harsh as the one your character is.
Celeste is quite a real character as well, because she represents a lot of females in Africa.
Do you know?
Around the world.
Yeah, were you aware of that, your responsibility, or has that grown the more you talked about the film, the more you've kind of come to know about what the character symbolises?
No, I was not aware at all that there were 15-year-old, 12-year-old, 13-year-old sex workers until the film, actually. Because Debs told me about, I think, some girls she met in Burundi, and how they would leave at like 6 p.m. to start work. And these girls were like 12, 13. So being in the film, it really opened my eyes, and it allowed me to see what other people go through. And I don't take much for granted anymore, to be honest.
And I guess that's one of the messages you get from the film. Des, when you are making a film that is about dreams, and it is about football, in a sort of the message of football in some way, but you've had to kind of put in the kind of real politics of Africa. How did you kind of come to juggle that kind of the twin messages of your film, if you like?
I think we were incredibly keen to show a different side of Africa, but we didn't want to be dishonest either. So we
different to what side?
Different to often the films that you get are kind of crazy, savage war stories, sometimes fronted by white people. It just sort of felt like there are amazingly engaging stories that can be fronted by African characters, African kids particularly. And it, you know, even though we wanted it to be magical and a bit larger than life and a real sort of full of creativity family film, we wanted it also to have its feet on the ground and be hopefully humanising some issues that it's quite difficult to engage to in the way that they get represented on the news sometimes.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It was always part of the same package as far as we were concerned.
Yeah. I must ask you guys, we're here as part of the London Film Festival. Your film then comes out across the UK to kind of, I hope, become a big hit with people. But it was the Family Gala here at the London Film Festival. I just want to ask you how that was for you. How was that for you, Sherry? Weird, because it's your film, but it's also your hometown as well, having it come back, like your big premiere here in London.
Yeah, the Family Gala, the premiere was just, it was amazing. I didn't expect to see so many people, and I had this feeling that the carpet wouldn't actually be red, because I had Googled Odeon West End and it came up with a blue carpet. But when it was red, I was like, oh, thank God. And then like the car drove onto the carpet and I was like, wow, we look really important. So when we stepped out, like everyone was just screaming, and it was like, I felt like a celebrity.
We should have given you a green carpet, really.
No, please.
You want it red carpet. You want, if I'm doing red carpet and this is my only ever chance, I want it red. I want the whole thing, the whole Princess Diana thing.
Yeah,
it was fantastic.
It was one of the best days of my life. It was I felt like it was like a little wedding kind of thing.
Brilliant. Debs, your film actually has been compared, and not unfavourably, I may say, to Slumdog Millionaire, which, you know, even just the very idea must have been, but has that film been an influence in the kind of arc that you've made? Because that is a film about the hardship of life in a third world country, and yet it's kind of got a sort of Western elements, and it's got this kind of dream narrative. Did you think about that could work?
Well, Slumdog was, I mean, it's an amazing film, so to be compared to it is kind of mental, sort of flattering and a bit humbling as well. But the I think the what it showed more than anything was that there's a big appetite for stories that open the box a little bit on the stuff that we're used to, and stories coming from different places, stories from kids, from you know, unusual environments. So it felt like it showed that there was an audience, and therefore gave us a platform to tell this.
I mean, who do you think? Because it played as a Family Gala, which I think is great, sort of a family. But what you guys have seen the film now, you kids. Would you, if you were in Africa, would you tell your friends to see this film? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they would get
it's
it.
Really nice. It shows how African kids are living.
Guys, absolutely brilliant to meet you. I loved your film. I thought it was, it just had me kind of like whooping in my seat. It has exactly the right spirit, but also very moving as well. All three of you, brilliant performances and well managed. Debs Gardner-Patterson, thanks very much for coming on Film Weekly.
Thank you. Brilliant.
And the unstoppable, unsavable Jabulani ball of fun that is Africa United is on general release here in the UK from Friday, the 22nd of October. That's it for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is the jazzy, funky-infused soundtrack to the film Red by Christoph Beck. We're always keen to hear your views on the films we've been talking about and our interviews. The best way to follow us is on Facebook. Film Weekly fans, join up, sign in, and let us know what you feel. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's farewell and see you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.